of Simon's Hidden Champions. Criteria for inclusion, at least global top three in their market, less than $4 billion in revenue. Badr, Iceland, 80% world market share, fish processing systems. Gallagher, New Zealand, electric fences. WET, Germany, heated car seat technology, 50% world market share. Garrett's, Germany, theater curtains and stage equipment. Electronite, Belgium, sensors for the steel industry. Essel Propack, India, toothpaste tubes. SGS, Switzerland, product auditing and certification. Dello, Germany, specialty adhesives. Amarim, Portugal, cork products. EOS, Germany, laser sintering. Omicron, Germany, tunnel grid microscopy. Dixon Constant, France, technical textiles. OC Tanner, United States, employee recognition systems. Haganese, United States, powder metallurgy supplies. 4.3.5, the Mittelstand. Agile creatures darting between the legs of multinational monsters. Bloomberg Businessweek on the effectiveness of German Mittelstand companies. Mid-size, niche-dominating firms, Mittelstanders, are unequivocally responsible for Germany's stunning, sustaining, peerless export record. For years, Germany ranked number one in exports, ahead of the United States, Japan, and China. More recently, China has taken over the top spot on the list. 4.4.1. Axiom. Better before cheaper. During a five-year research effort, Deloitte senior partners Michael Rayner and Mumtaz Ahmed mined a database of over 25,000 companies from hundreds of industries stretching back 45 years. They uncovered 344 firms whose performance qualified as statistically exceptional. Finally, following more analytic winnowing, the set was reduced to 27 firms whose long-term strategies were examined in excruciating detail. Those surviving this hyper-intense scrutiny included Linear Technology, Thomas & Betts, Weiss Markets, and Heartland Express. The research became the basis for the masterful book, The Three Rules, How Exceptional Companies Think. Dozens of plausible hypotheses regarding superior performance were tested, and the winners, the three and only three rules that emerged were: 1. Better before cheaper. 2. Revenue before cost. 3. There are no other rules. This may sound straightforward and obvious. It is not. Those who stick to these dictums through hell and high water are, the three rules research underscores, rare indeed. Remember above, 27 out of 25,000. 4.4.2, Axiom, Value Before Short-Term Earnings. Similarly striking conclusions were reached by Fortune's premier management expert, Jeff Colvin, in a feature article titled, The Economy is Scary, But Smart Companies Can Dominate. Colvin offers these findings from the superior performers. 1. They manage for long-term value, not for short-term earnings. 2. They get radically customer-centric. 3. They keep developing human capital. Bingo, bingo, bingo. 4.4.3. Axiom. Cost-cutting is a death spiral. Our whole story is growing revenue. Take 3. Recall from the introduction the tale of the 2 million dog biscuits. That is, the Commerce Bank, Metro Bank, Vernon Hill story. Get them into the branches, keep the branches open, give them love, turn them into fans, sell Commerce for $8.6 billion to TD Bank, then take the show to the United Kingdom with Metro Bank, and in short order grab 1 million accounts away from the established banks. The guiding philosophy, wholly consistent with the first two takes above. 1. Are you going to cost cut your way to prosperity, or are you going to spend your way to prosperity? 2. Overinvest in our people, overinvest in our facilities. 3. Cost cutting is a death spiral. Our whole story is growing revenue. SME dogma. Take 1 equals take 2 equals take 3. Top line priority. Product and service excellence. Invest in people. 4.4.4. Axiom. There need be no such thing as a commodity. David Lefkowitz of Lefco Renovations in Atlanta avoids standard pitch letters. Instead, when he starts a home remodeling project, he writes to the neighbors saying he wants to avoid inconveniencing them. He invites them to call him personally with any complaints. Many save his letters and, impressed by his courtesy, hire him later. From Vern Harnish in Fortune. I hate the word commodity, as in, this is a commodity market. You sell on cost or else. As I see it, and, above, as David Lefkowitz of Lefco Renovation sees it, commodity is a state of mind, a loser's state of mind. Anything can be significantly, dramatically differentiated. The opportunity for discernible excellence is ubiquitous. For example, the local plumber or electrician does not provide a commodity service if he or she knows the job, if he or she is learning new tricks all the time, if he or she has a good disposition, if he or she shows up on time, if he or she is neatly dressed, if he or she has a spiffy truck, if he or she fixes the problem in an elegant and timely fashion and clearly explains what was done and why it was done this way or that. If he or she cleans up so that after the fact the client could eat off the job site floor. If he or she volunteers to do a few tiny tasks outside the one on hand, gratis. If he or she calls, call equals phone, not email, 24 hours later to make sure all is well. If, perhaps, he or she creates a blog with occasional posts featuring practical tips for his or her clientele. For example, a tiny Virginia swimming pool company became a literal best in the world following such a social media strategy. If, he or she ain't a commodity. I call such decommoditization and relentless pursuit of excellence DWPF, distinction worth paying for. I had an out-and-out tiff in the course of a late 2016 speech. It was to a group of franchisees who were complaining bitterly that their harrowing situation, new competitors, new technology, new regulations, forced them to pay low wages, which in turn often led to outbreaks of shabby work and poor customer service. I acknowledge that I went a little off the rails chastising them, summoning in particular the spirit of George Whalen and Vernon Hill and Larry Janeski and Jim Penman and David Lefkowitz. I said I thought their avowed goal should be to pay the highest wages in the industry and to enable that by providing be the best, only ones who do what we do, service worthy of their charging a significant above-market price. There was substantial pushback, though my day was saved when perhaps the most successful and quite large franchisee rose, literally, to my defense and insisted that what I had said was dead on and needed saying. 4.4.5. My 1 million jobs SME dream. My mind returned to that hypothetical plumber electrician not too long ago. On my way to pick up plans from a local engineering firm for a septic system repair, I was driving through a suburban area about 50 miles south of Boston. At one point, I passed a modest-sized quadrangle with shops and offices. The roadside sign included quilt shop, wedding cake provider, swimming pool sales, service, and installation company, tailor offering alterations, medical billing service, solo lawyer, fitness center, etc. There are thousands upon thousands of such setups around the country. Fact is, they employ millions of us. And another fact is that each and every one has the opportunity to be no less than a local superstar. No, not a $1 trillion unicorn, but to be like that hypothetical plumber electrician or the real David Lefkowitz cited above, to be special, very special, to be the best, to be an employer of choice as well, not hiring dozens, but with sustained stellar performance and growing reputation, increasing staff size from 3 to 5 or 6 or even 9. And the jobs added would be damn good jobs. Probably not terribly high-paying jobs, but moderate-paying jobs at a great company. The 3 or 5 or 6 or 9 employees of this little be-the-best outfit would ingest a bushel of good habits and pick up precious hard and soft skills that would increase their employability quotient and, thus, serve them well in the years or even decades to come. Despite at first blush what appear to be ordinary-sounding services, none of these operations needs to be a commodity. Special, excellent, wow, only ones in the region who do what we do, is not an opportunity open to a chosen few. These differentiating attributes are available to anyone with a vivid imagination, a sterling work ethic, a passion for improvement, a caring attitude, and an unwavering pursuit of excellence. Oddly enough, after picking up my septic plans, I went on to get a haircut. I was a bit early and sat down for a wait. As fate would have it, there was a small framed motto on the magazine table next to me. When you support small business, you support a dream. What a fitting end to my wee local journey. Dream on. Excellence or bust. Be the best. An employer of choice. Dream big. Be the best. Universal excellence. Program 1 million good new jobs. 1 million small businesses, less than, say, 10 employees, commit in 2018 to providing their customers with a level of excellence and wow such that each of said businesses will prosper to the point of needing to hire one new employee, who in turn they will train in excellence and wow to the extent that the new employee's future job prospects are exponentially improved. Bottom line regarding my dream 1 million. From individual to community to nation, everyone wins. Big time. I'm going a bit batty on this topic. Well, perhaps more than a bit. Whenever I drive or walk past a small business, I start imagining the additional services they could offer, the infinite number of ways in which they could stand out, what excellence would look like in their context. There really are no limits to this sort of thinking. Call it Tom's SME Nirvana. Why not? 4.5. Hope equals SMEs. We are in no danger of running out of new combinations to try. Even if technology froze today, we have more possible ways of configuring the different applications, machines, tasks, and distribution channels to create new processes and products than we could ever exhaust. Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee, Race Against the Machine, How the Digital Revolution is Accelerating Innovation, Driving Productivity, and Irreversibly Transforming Employment and the Economy. If there's hope of weathering the coming tech tsunami, and Brynjolfsson and McAfee and I think there is hope, it will not come from the sputtering behemoths, but from entrepreneurs, the likes of Coppens, Jungle Gyms, Basement Systems, Apt Electronics, Burlingham Small Giants, Taylor's Brilliant Firms, and the Mittelstanders of Germany or any other nation. 3. People. 5. One more damn time. Putting people first. My story. Pat Carrigan was standing when I entered her Bay City, Michigan office in early 1988. not as a demonstration of good manners, but because she didn't want to start off with formalities across a desk. If we were here to talk about her plant, then we needed, in moment number one, to get out onto the shop floor. I was visiting to shoot a segment for her on a PBS special subsequently titled The Leadership Alliance. Pat was the first woman to run a General Motors plant, Lakewood, Georgia. But after performing a miracle there, turning war with the UAW into a wildly productive peace, among other things, several thousand jobs lost in a shutdown were resurrected, she had been moved to Bay City to captain a struggling GM powertrain operation. Pat and I and my director headed out on the floor. There was no camera running. We were merely getting a feel for the place and no execs or exec assistants in tow. I don't want to deify Pat, but that next hour or so was a marvel of extraordinary ordinariness. I honest to God believe that she knew the names of every one of her 1,000-plus employees, and she seemed to know a little something about each one. On several occasions, as if we weren't there, she'd ask them about something they were doing and always ended with, "Don't forget our golden rule. If there's anything I can do to help, it's your responsibility to ask, and my door is always open." This, we were told by several people, was routine, not a made-for-TV line, and that the door was always open. Pat ended our little tour by dropping us off at the office of the plant's UAW boss. They exchanged some social chit-chat and talked about a couple of small items on their mutual agenda. Pat reported on a meeting with her GM higher-ups the day before, rolling her eyes a couple of times about some hurdles she'd run into. They both laughed. She closed with that apparently characteristic, "Let me know if I can help." When Pat left, we sat down, and the UAW chief told us a half-an-hour tale of the before-after Pat story. One item sticks in my mind. I'll do my best, though I acknowledge that my quotes are a bit short of 100% accurate. Pat had just arrived at midday, and maybe an hour afterward there's a knock on my door, and this woman says, "I'm Pat Carrigan. Can I come in and say hello?" So far, so good, but you may have trouble believing the next bit. He continued, "Tom, I'd been the union guy in charge here for a decade. It was the first time the plant manager had ever come to my office door and knocked and asked permission to enter in 10 years. Previously, when anything came up, I was summoned to the office for meetings." He must have said "first time" about 3 times. Later, with camera rolling, he uttered my favorite line in the subsequent PBS show, "Pat Carrigan ain't got a phony bone in her body." On the first time point again, we did a shoot with a half a dozen line workers at a shift change time one morning. The seniority was uniformly high. The 6 collectively represented 100-plus years of plant experience. To my utter astonishment, which you can see on my face on the screen, they said, and I made each one repeat it on camera, that they had never met a plant manager in their workspace until Pat arrived. I also asked them if they'd had any priming for my interview. One said, "Yeah, the UAW boss mentioned before told us, Pat says no bullshit. Tell these guys, me and my director, the truth, warts and all, no pretty stuff." So this chapter is about putting people really first, beyond the slogans. The intellectual content in this chapter does not require an advanced degree to understand. It could consist of 25 or 125 stories about Pat Carrigan-like people who achieved stunning results by remembering names, wandering the floor asking, "How can I help?" and listening 10 times more than talking. If my story were complicated, then my blood pressure would be much lower. If there were a convoluted formula, then you could excuse people for getting it wrong. But it's by and large not complicated. Hence, there is zero, repeat, zero, excuse for not getting it right. Accordingly, my private name for this chapter is the batshit chapter. I go batshit over bosses who don't ask, "How can I help?" I go batshit over bosses who are not maniacal about training, training, and more training. So, alas, I go batshit a lot, and I have, without let-up, for the last 35 years. Have a look at what follows, then tell me what's so hard about it. I'm not very religious, but there is a religious benefit in all this. If you help people, you'll also feel better about yourself and your short visit here on Earth. Hey, I'm writing this on a Sunday, hence my micro-sermon. 2 other Pat Carrigan notes. After her retirement from GM, the Michigan legislature passed a joint resolution honoring her work. Secondly, let me make it clear that my Carrigan TV segment was not a whitewash. My director had been Mike Wallace's director at CBS's 60 Minutes, and he was no pussycat and could detect bullshit from 100 miles away. I observed his BS detector at work on several occasions. The People Narrative 5.1 People Really First 13 Succinct Takes Not rocket science. It's the people who do the work. It's the people who make the customer connection scintillating or sour. It's the people who generate the growth and profit. It's the people that matter, as individuals as much or more than as service providers. 5.1.1 Brand Equals Talent. This is news? Not for the Metropolitan Opera, not for the MIT Media Lab, not for the Golden State Warriors, but, alas, so it appears to be for many in business. Which is why, at age 75, I'm writing this book and still madly traveling around the world, pontificating on the obvious instead of snoozing on the front porch rocker. So I have this image. The famous pro football coach sends me an email, asks me to consult on the effectiveness of his organization. I agree and name an outrageous sum. He agrees. I do my review, which takes about a month. Time to report. I go into the famous coach's office and we exchange pleasantries. Then I assume a stern face and begin. Coach, I think your players are your most important asset. At that point, he picks up a very heavy trophy sitting on his desk and throws it at me and I run like hell. I contend that I would have had a different reception in the average corporate office. My observation would have been viewed as astute, and I would have been praised for my work, and the check would have arrived in the next mail. Of course I exaggerate, but I don't think I exaggerate all that much. 5.1.2, quote, people before strategy, unquote. Source, that's the title. Lead article, Harvard Business Review, July-August 2015, by Ram Charan, Dominic Barton, the managing director of McKinsey, and Dennis Carey. Ah, my God, even McKinsey, the strategy quant headquarters of the world, apparently has come around to people first. Hallelujah. 5.1.3. You have to treat your employees like customers. That quote, courtesy of Herb Kelleher, Southwest Airlines founder and former CEO, upon being asked his number one secret to success. Over the years, I've spent a substantial amount of time with Kelleher. This is not some sort of a marketing slogan. It is gospel in an industry, the airlines, where time and again over the last 25 years, employees have faced cuts and cuts and then more cuts as competition heated up and then boiled over. FYI, when Kelleher retired, Southwest unionized pilots took out and paid for full-page newspaper ads thanking him for his 35 years of inspired leadership. 5.1.4. If you want staff to give great service to staff. That quote per Ari Weinzweig, Zingerman's, a superfood emporium, from Bo Burlingham's book, Small Giants, Companies That Choose to Be Great Instead of Big. Read this quote a couple of times. You, boss, are in the service business. That is, it is your number one job to serve your employees more or less full time. Another successful entrepreneur put it this way. When I hire someone, that's when I go to work for them. Please do not think of these section headers as clever lines. Please consider them to be what in fact they are, profound truths. So, does or will or did your day reflect the priority implied by these quotes? Please do not generalize. Be precise. 5.1.5. What employees experience, customers will experience. The best marketing is happy, engaged employees. Your customers will never be any happier than your employees. That one from successful entrepreneur and service guru John DeJulius from his book, The Customer Service Revolution, Overthrow Conventional Business, Inspire Employees, and Change the World. So true. This is such a lovely, parsimonious use of words. Again, please, please don't speed through. Instead, pause, reflect, and perhaps post it on the wall behind your desk as a constant reminder. FYI Redux, this is not rocket science. 5.1.6, we are ladies and gentlemen serving ladies and gentlemen. That's from the Ritz-Carlton Credo. The company is routinely voted one of the best companies to work for in America. In the hotel business, members of frontline staff have historically been treated more like cannon fodder than ladies and gentlemen. This mark of respect, certified as a written core belief, is a very big deal, and, in my experience, very much for real. Employees as ladies and gentlemen. Love it. 5.1.7. Business has to give people enriching, rewarding lives, or it's simply not worth doing. From Richard Branson. In my translation, Branson is effectively saying that no matter how cool or irresistible or profitable your product or service may be, the great game of business is not to be played unless your employees are the ultimate winners. Remember these words, not worth doing. Take note, this quote is in no way soft. Simply put, helping your employees achieve a worthwhile future turns out to be the most profitable way to run a company, period. 5.1.8 from Ralph Nader. I start with the premise that the function of leadership is to produce more leaders, not more followers. Why, oh why, oh why, oh why do so few understand this? I know I say that a lot, particularly in this chapter. When I wrote The Brand U50 in 1999, so many bosses said that the idea of, say, 25 frisky brand U's running around was tantamount to anarchy. I disagreed vociferously and argued that in our brave new world, survival depends on each of our 25 or 2 or 250 employees being personal growth fanatics with an entrepreneurial bent. Only by following that path do the workers in the organizations have a chance of adapting and surviving, let alone thriving. We want, for the sake of survival, leaders all. Mr. Nader pegged it. 5.1.9. Now please consider adding hostmanship, leader as host to her employees. The path to a hostmanship culture paradoxically does not go through the guest. True hostmanship leaders focused first on their employees. We went through the hotel immediately upon acquiring it and made a consideration renovation. Instead of redoing bathrooms, dining rooms, and guest rooms, we gave employees new uniforms, bought flowers and fruit, and changed colors. Our focus was totally on the staff. They were the ones we wanted to make happy. We wanted them to wake up every morning excited about a new day at work. From Jan Gunnarsson and Ollie Blum, Hostmanship, the Art of Making People Feel Welcome. Gunnarsson and Blum are management gurus and own a hotel. This ain't theory. Consideration renovation, a lovely term. Ponder it. The authors continue. Would you prefer to stay at a hotel where the staff love their work or where management has made customers its highest priority? At first blush, that might sound odd. But we often see a mission statement that puts the customer first and pays but lip service to the employees who serve that customer. How often is this the case? Alas, I would say with confidence, far more often than not. The reverse, the logic presented here, is well worth reflecting upon, which is to say it is right on the money. 5.1.10. Stretch your imagination. manager as dream manager. An organization can only become the best version of itself to the extent that the people who drive that organization are striving to become better versions of themselves. Our employees are our first customers and our most influential customers. From Matthew Kelly, The Dream Manager. Become better versions of themselves. Every employee, Kelly asserts, has a dream related to his or her current job and, most likely, more generally regarding his or her future. For example, consider the hotel housekeeper, a single mom with two kids and two jobs who would dearly love to work toward a junior college certificate or degree or something similar that would help her imagine a future with options unrelated to mops, rags, and vacuum cleaners. Focusing on helping employees attain those on or off the job dreams, hence the boss as dream manager, is simply an extraordinarily effective way to create an environment where employees strive to improve themselves more or less each and every day, and in the process almost invariably serve each other and the client with verve. And I'd add, it's also the decent thing to do in a world where the only possibility of continued employability is growth. The dream manager, presented in parable form, normally not my cup of tea, is in fact directly based on an extremely successful industrial cleaning services company that preferred not to be identified. I was fortunate enough to meet the publicity-shy CEO. She's the real thing. Thanks to Matthew Kelly, each time I now come in contact with, say, a frontline hotel employee, I wonder if she or he is lucky enough to have a dream manager. As usual, and it must be regularly repeated, the key to implementing some version of the dream manager approach is corporate culture. The leadership team must be unanimously disposed toward helpfulness, must genuinely be engaged with abetting large-scale dream fulfillment. Otherwise, the idea will be a flop and will quite likely do harm, the harm of promises unfulfilled. 5.1.11. Staff first, a healthcare revolution. Nobody comes home after a surgery saying, "Man, that was the best suturing I've ever seen," or, "Sweet, they took out the correct kidney." Instead, we talk about the people who took care of us, the ones who coordinated the whole procedure, everyone from the receptionist to the nurses to the surgeon. And we don't just tell stories around the dinner table. We share our experiences through conversations with friends and colleagues and via social media sites like Facebook and Twitter. Paul Spiegelman and Britt Barrett. Patients come second. Leading change by changing the way you lead. Healthcare is our biggest industry by far, and surely the most complex. Patients are increasingly treated like cattle. For example, docs are saddled with ridiculous quotas on patients to be seen per day, which frequently results in a perfunctory visit that in turn leads to diagnoses that all too frequently miss the mark. Then there's the technology that effectively requires a nurse to spend her bedside time entering data into a tablet. Hence, and numerous studies confirm this, she rarely even makes eye contact, which is all important to healing, with the patient. The point here is that the harried hospital staffer cannot give the patient memorable or compassionate or safe care until the hospital focuses on dealing with the constraints that keep the staffer from doing so. Following something like the hostmanship vignette above, the wise boss might start with an employee-focused consideration renovation. Only after that can we rightfully expect the quality of customer, patient, care to soar. Happy, or at least not unhappy, employee equals better inpatient care and, which has been repeatedly demonstrated, significantly better patient outcomes. In summary, first things first. And in this case, the story told in Patients Come Second, that first thing is to enable and encourage hospital employees to do what caused so many of them to go into the trade in the first place. That is, to give emotionally supportive assistance to the bedridden, usually fearful, and typically overwhelmed patient. pause for a moment, or two, or three, or four, or five, or ten. Carefully re-listen to each of the lead quotes in this section and reflect on the precise wording. Business is not worth doing if you don't enhance the lives of your employees. From an unimpeachable source, Richard Branson, who has tackled and mastered the toughest industries, not worth doing. If it ain't great for the workforce, forget about it. And Southwest Airlines founder Herb Kelleher chimes in. Asked his secret to success, he, like Conrad Hilton in the lead-off to this book, uttered but a single sentence. The Southwest employee is customer number one. Super Deli Man Ari Weinzweig, a star of the book Small Giants, says his role is to give great service to his staff. John DeJulius tells us that our paying customers will never be any happier than the employees who serve them. And employees first, consideration renovation. And dream managers who help employees achieve life goals, often independent of the firm, etc. Action. I'd ask you to think back in some detail on the last 24 hours. How do you and your organization measure up, specifics please, on these formulations from Business Hall of Famers? Please, these are not meant to be cool quotes. These are hard-nosed, profit-maximizing, practical approaches in enterprises large and small in tougher-than-tough industries that can be operationalized starting now. 5.1.12. My summary of all this. Excellent customer experiences depend entirely on excellent employee experiences. If you want to wow your customers, first you must wow those who wow the customers. 5.2.1. A brief note on people really first leadership. Less gets religion. I got as excited about developing people as I had been about identifying fashion trends. Les Wexner, founder, CEO, The Limited Brands. Founder CEO Les Wexner's Limited Brands saga almost merits the term peerless. In addition to his revolutionary impact on affordable fashion retailing, he put together a long-term financial success record that Business Week assessed, among other things, as better than that of Jack Welch during his storied time at GE's helm. In the Business Week article, Wexner responded to a query about the source of his long-term success with the quote above. He reported that as time went on, he realized expanding his enterprise and keeping it fresh was entirely dependent upon creating a peerless team, from the young saleswoman on the floor to his portfolio of executives. In fact, that is the subtext of virtually all the quotes above. I'm fortunate enough to have gotten to know most of the execs who were quoted, including Wexner. Their passion for putting people at the top of the agenda today and over the long term unmistakably stands out. 5.2.2. People really first. What is the moment-to-moment translation of putting people first? The following is an exchange that occurred at a break in a seminar a while back. So, Tom, the core of your practice is people first. But what does that really mean? How does that translate into my day's work? I paused for quite a while before answering, several responses churning through my head. And then something almost literally clicked. I recalled a conversation from some years ago with an exceptionally successful Nordstrom regional manager. We were talking about this and that, and then, and I don't know what triggered it, she said almost wistfully, and my memory here is quite vivid, "What I do today is important to the company, but it will never match the joy of having my own store as I did for almost 5 years. There were always a dozen problems to solve, but when I was stuck or frustrated or just plain weary, I knew exactly what to do. I'd get up from my desk and wander through the store. I'd chat up an employee for 30 seconds or sometimes 5 minutes. I'd probably meander all told for about a half an hour. Corny as it probably sounds, just being in their presence was a genuine high. We were truly a team and we cared about each other. They were, in fact, my personal community. I don't want to sound melodramatic, but when I got back to my desk after that 30 minutes or so roaming the store, my head would be clear, and usually I saw the problem that had befuddled me transform itself into an opportunity to do something positive. Now that I'm an executive, I'll never have that thrill again. That, dear colleagues, is a people person. 5.3. People really first. The fully engaged social employee empowered by AI. To some, people first might seem like an anachronism as artificial intelligence continues its hell-bent drive toward job restructuring and often destruction. But there is a sound argument that says precisely the opposite is the case. People really first will in fact be a survivor's trait. It can and most likely will be more important than ever. Moreover, there is a case for AI as ally rather than destroyer. That is, fully empowered employees interacting to use AI to create novel, highly differentiated customer experiences. For example, in their pioneering book, The Social Employee, Cheryl Burgess and Mark Burgess describe a world in which every employee, augmented rather than deconstructed by the new technology, adds significant and distinct value as he or she potentially becomes no less than an innovating customer contact star. Among giant firms, IBM has been a leader of the pack in pursuing this strategy of radically enhanced all-hands technology-powered engagement. The emerging theory, in the words of Ethan McCarty, former IBM Director of Enterprise Social Strategy, goes something like this. Picture a ball and a bag of marbles side by side. The two items might have the same volume. That is, if you drop them into a bucket, they would displace the same amount of water. The difference, however, lies in the surface area. A bag of marbles is comprised of several individual pieces, and the combined surface area of all the marbles far outstrips, if the bag is sizable by orders of magnitude, the surface area of a single ball. The expanded surface area within the bag of marbles represents a social brand's increased diversity. The surfaces of each of the marbles connect and interact with each other in unique ways, offering customers and employees alike a variety of paths toward a myriad of solutions. If none of the paths prove to be suitable, social employees can carve out new paths on their own. I think this image is exceptionally powerful. In simple terms, a world of 100% engaged employees exploiting rather than being exploited by AI can bring exceptional innovative potential to their tasks, compared with the narrow-gauge version of empowered that prevails in the relatively static organizational models that are still the norm. While the bag of marbles image is compelling, the challenge of the doing is monumental and is effectively addressed by the Burgesses in The Social Employee. Suffice it to say that every aspect of the enterprise must be transformed. Hiring, training and development, execution and control mechanisms, and above all, the establishment of a corporate culture that supports a radically new approach to organizing and wholesale employee growth. 5.4. People first. Hiring. In short, hiring is the most important aspect of business and yet remains woefully misunderstood. The Wall Street Journal. Review of WHO, the A Method for Hiring. Jeff Smart and Randy Street. Re-listen. Strong statement, correct statement, action item of the first order. And development can help great people be even better. But if I had a dollar to spend, I'd spend 70 cents getting the right person in the door. Paul Russell, Director, Leadership and Development, Google. So how do you rate your hiring skills? Can you, Think long and hard and honestly on this. Can you call yourself a true hiring professional? Are you an assiduous student of all that goes into effective hiring? For one thing, how many books on hiring per se have you read? Have you ever taken a course exclusively focused on hiring? If, as stated above, hiring is the, quote, most important aspect of business, unquote, and business is what you do, then hiring excellence deserves at least the same attention that would go into becoming a first-rate mechanical engineer or biochemist, right? 5.4.1, hiring. Attributes that make all the difference, and that too often get short shrift. To create cultures for tomorrow that can deliver startling innovations on a regular basis and distinct, emotionally fulfilling customer experiences, one needs to emphasize far more than technical skills, more than even superb technical skills in the hiring process. 5.4.1.1. Listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, being warm. Take Southwest Airlines. It remains a low-price airline with a high-value people culture that delivers top-rated customer service and experiences. It begins, from pilots and mechanics to flight attendants, with a distinctive hiring approach. Former Southwest President Colleen Barrett says, "We look for listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, being warm." Is Barrett's list for public consumption, or is it real? An example. I'm about to board a Southwest flight from Albany, New York to Baltimore. The plane is ready for boarding. As is typical, three or four wheelchairs are lined up at the gate. The crew makes their appearance, obviously rushing from a flight that arrived late, and heads for the jetway. The pilot stops, turns to the older woman in the first wheelchair in line and says, "May I help you down the jetway?" She says, "Thank you, yes." Off she goes with the pilot conveying her to the aircraft. I've chalked up about 10,000 flight legs, yet this experience was a first. I actually think I gasped. Airlines are frequently entry number one on the customer unfriendly lists. I contend that the pilot's courtesy, and courtesy while under pressure to boot, was no accident. That in fact it was a direct byproduct of, we look for listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, being warm. 5.4.1.2. Nice. When we talk about soft traits, one would hardly expect the conversation to turn to a pharmaceutical company. Well, let me introduce you to Peter Miller, CEO of Pharma's Optinose. The ultimate filter we use in the hiring process is that we only hire nice people. When we finish assessing skills, we do something called running the gauntlet. We have them interact with 15 or 20 people, and every one of them has what I call a blackball vote, which means they can say if we should not hire that person. Miller continues, "I believe in culture so strongly that one bad apple can spoil the bunch. There are enough really talented people out there who are nice. You don't really need to put up with people who act like jerks." Nice. Pharmaceuticals. Yes. Along this same line, a friend reports on an extremely successful New Zealand company in a very competitive environment within the entertainment industry. The founder's chief hiring criterion, no shitheads. I'll second that. 5.4.1.3. Empathy. This is courtesy of Stuart Butterfield, co-founder and CEO of Slack and founder of Flickr. When we talk about the qualities we want in people, empathy is a big one. If you can empathize with people, then you can do a good job. If you have no ability to empathize, then it's difficult to give people feedback, and it is difficult to help people improve. Everything becomes harder. One way that empathy manifests itself is courtesy. It's not just a veneer of politeness, but actually trying to anticipate someone else's needs and meeting them in advance. 5.4.1.4 Better people. Character. Let's head for the football field. Surely the quality of the physical skills wins out. Not according to coaching legend Bo Schembechler. I can't tell you how many times we passed up hotshots for guys we thought were better people and watched our guys do a lot better than the big names, not just in the classroom but on the field. And, naturally, after they graduated too. Again and again, the blue chips faded out, and our little up-and-comers clawed their way to all-conference and all-America teams. The legendary basketball coach John Wooden's parallel version of this was, ability may get you to the top, but it takes character to keep you there. Character. Theo gets religion. 108-year drought comes to an end. In mid-2017, Fortune magazine featured World's 50 Greatest Leaders. Astoundingly, Theo Epstein, the general manager who took the Chicago Cubs to their first World Series triumph in 108 years, topped the list. The story revolved around a single word, character. Against long odds, Epstein had taken the Boston Red Sox to the top of the heap, thanks significantly to hiring decisions based on advanced statistical analysis, analytics. But then the team effectively fell apart, due mostly to internal dissension, and Mr. Epstein moved on to the Cubs, and, it turns out, he discovered character. Fortune reports. Character and chemistry were strengths that a quant approach couldn't capture. And in 2011, in what turned out to be Epstein's final season in Boston, their absence was painfully clear as the team underwent a late-season collapse. The more the team lost, the more it broke apart from within. Once he joined the Cubs, Epstein gave his scouts very specific marching orders. They were to dig into a player's makeup by talking to just about anybody who knew him. Parents, guidance counselors, teammates, girlfriends, siblings. Cubs' scouting reports would never look the same again. Epstein went way beyond the stats and hired effectively for character. The Cubs in 2016 ended a 108-year championship drought. Could the story be that simple? Of course not. On the other hand, the central theme, according to those I've talked with, is accurate, which makes enormous sense to me. 5.4.1.5 Curiosity. Going to a slightly different compass point, there's another attribute that takes on special meaning in these upside-down times. For a Vanity Fair interview, Michael Bloomberg was asked to provide his most significant trait. He gave a one-word reply. Curiosity. In Workplace 2018, I insist that curiosity should be a must-have for 100% of jobs. Curiosity could legitimately be called the number one way in which we individually and collectively differentiate ourselves in the age of automation. Some argue, including many who are among converts to algorithmic hiring, that there are jobs where keeping one's nose to the grindstone full-time is imperative, and I am not arguing that there are not degrees of curiosity. What we might desire in a research scientist is not what we might seek in a call center employee or hotel housekeeper. Nonetheless, I will go to the mat when it comes to voting in any job slot for those who are inclined to regularly ask why or why not. Consider a hotel housekeeping team. Our algorithmic hiring friends may well be able to deliver in the short term a 6% increase in productivity from their hiring practices based on big data correlations. But over the long term, I will bet a pretty penny that my smiling, nice, empathetic, curious housekeeping team working in a hotel where ladies and gentlemen serve ladies and gentlemen will win out over the algorithmically hired gang very decisively. Want to bet? 5.4.1.6 Bottom line. Be explicit. use these words, damn it, not HR gobbledygook equivalents. Listening, caring, smiling, saying thank you, being warm, nice, empathy, better people, character, curiosity, no jerks, no shitheads. I cannot think of any position in any company of any size where these 12 characteristics would not pay off. Can you? I repeat. Be explicit. Use these exact words. I cannot resist adding two more terms, though perhaps not for every job. Courtesy of Jeffrey Rothfetter in Driving Honda, inside the world's most innovative car company. Ask for the single most important attribute that an ideal Honda applicant should have. Sachiro Honda noted that he preferred people who have been in trouble. He believed genius arose from idiosyncrasy. Nonconformity is essential to an artist or an inventor, he told his workers. Hence my for your consideration addenda to the list above. People who have been in trouble. Nonconformity. 5.4.2.1. People first. The missing 50%. Don't bypass the quiet ones. Consider what was for me a life-changing book, namely Susan Cain's remarkable Quiet, The Power of Introverts in a World That Can't Stop Talking. Susan Cain claims, with fervor and a train car full of hard data, that we are idiots. Well, she doesn't do any such thing, but as I read the book, I felt like a complete idiot. By and large, well, almost without exception, employers gravitate, starting with the hiring process, toward the noisy ones. And that is a colossal mistake, essentially depriving ourselves of the services of the nearly half of the population of quiet ones who tend to think before they open their mouths and in general bring to the table a different and invaluable approach to their work. As to my idiocy, I get paid to be on top of all this, and in fact, I've been missing the boat by a jillion nautical miles. From Quiet. 1. The very questionable extrovert ideal. The extrovert ideal has been documented in many studies. Talkative people, for example, are rated as smarter, better looking, more interesting, and more desirable as friends. Velocity of speech counts as well as volume. We rank fast talkers as more competent and likable than slow ones. But we make a grave mistake to embrace the extrovert ideal so unthinkingly. 2. Conversational pairings. Experiment. The introverts and extroverts participated about equally, giving the lie to the idea that introverts talk less. But the introvert pairs tended to focus on one or two serious subjects of conversation, while the extrovert pairs were lighter-hearted and surfaced wider-ranging topics. 3. Limits to assertiveness. Also, remember the dangers of the new groupthink. If it's creativity you're after, ask your employees to solve problems alone before sharing their ideas. Don't mistake assertiveness or eloquence for good ideas. If you have a proactive workforce, and I hope you do, remember that they may perform better under an introverted leader than under an extroverted or charismatic one. 4. Quiet power. So the next time you see a person with a composed face and a soft voice, remember that inside her mind, she might be solving an equation, composing a sonnet, designing a hat. She might, that is, be deploying the power of quiet. I plead guilty. I have mostly fallen for the noisy ones. I've associated noisy with energetic, enthusiastic, and all those other positive terms in the first quote above. What a bunch of nonsense on my part. Damn it. Thank you, Susan Cain. Excuse the apparent hyperbole, but quiet has changed my life, and its message has become a bellowing, raging staple of every presentation I give. For God's sakes, I've been blowing off practically half the population. All hail the introverts. Please read the book and perhaps join Ms. Kane's Quiet Revolution on the web, www.quietrev.com. Quiet is an unequivocal call to direct action. Quiet rocks.